Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the November 7th meeting of the Ferndale City Council. We'd like to welcome you and also invite you to stand for the salute of our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, everybody. Our City Clerk, Susan Duncan, will do the roll call.
Council members are here. Council Member Henson.
Here.
Council Member Olson.
Here.
Council Member Taylor.
Here.
Council Member Waterford.
Here.
Council Member Birch.
Here.
Council Member Goodrich.
Here.
Everybody is here, and we're glad you're here. And this is the public comment time. If you don't have a, I'd like to call it a program, an agenda, we have copies up front, and there's an item that you'd like to talk about that's not on the agenda, come forward, and you've got 3 minutes to say anything you want to the Ferndale City Council. Just introduce yourself and tell us where you're from. There must be a football game going on tonight, isn't there? We will close public comment. At this time in our meeting, we have the consent agenda, which is before you, Council.
I'll make the motion that we approve the consent agenda.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to accept and adopt the consent agenda. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The consent agenda has been adopted. This is kind of a new experience for the City of Ferndale. We have done something that sounds sort of like the big leagues here. We have hired a lobbyist, and we are excited to introduce our lobbyist to you and show you the proposed agenda for the lobbyist. I'm going to pass this over to Greg Young, who's done the legwork on this.
Through the council's efforts and acquiescence, we have indeed hired a lobbyist to represent our interests down in Olympia. Brian Enslow is here tonight, and we also have the agenda, the legislative agenda. So this is the first time you've had a chance to meet Brian, so I'm hopeful that he'll be able to come up and kind of introduce himself and kind of give you an idea of what he's going to be doing and perhaps answer any questions you might have.
Welcome.
Great. Good evening. Thank you for giving me some of your time today. I know you're very busy and your time is valuable, especially on Monday Night Football.
Yes.
Just quickly, a little bit of introduction. I have been working in Olympia for almost 20 years now. I have experience both in the legislature and the executive branch. I have budgeted two different governors. I've also worked in the House Appropriations Committee. I've spent close to 8 years working directly with the Washington State Association of Counties, which is like a sister association to Association of Washington Cities, working specifically on local government issues. So I have both a really deep, rich background in local government as well as state government.
Can you move the mic a little bit? I'm not sure they can hear you in the back.
Sure, I'd love to. Thank
you.
Never know exactly how hot the microphone is. So, I'm currently self-employed, and I work as a contract lobbyist. It's a fairly new venture for me, so you're one of my first loves, so I am really excited about that. I do have a nice little client book that includes a insurance company, one of the larger insurance companies. It's the parent group is called Anthem. I also represent are you with the AWC insurance plan, the Employee Benefits Trust? I should have checked that first. That's one of my clients as well. So, I'm really looking forward to developing this relationship and getting to know you all a little bit better. I can talk a little bit about the legislative agenda if you'd like, or just the session, or if you'd like, if you want to ask me questions about my background, I'd love to answer some at this time.
Council, questions? Keep going on. You got their attention.
Great. Councilmember Watson. Oh, okay. It's been made aware to me that you've had an opportunity to review the proposed legislative agenda. It is important in the current environment to have modest expectations. We know there's a lot of uncertainty tomorrow and the amount of days it will take to untangle the uncertainty. And I think we'll have to sort some things out, and that might adjust what we think those opportunities are specifically for this region. There's going to be a lot in flux in the Senate. You obviously have some really good leadership for this area in the Senate, and that's in the balance. So we'll see how that goes. There was a large investment made in this area in the transportation budget. It's it's tantamount that you have someone there that can be your eyes and ears, and I am fully aware of that. We expect with that kind of investment that there'll be attention on it, and there will be moving parts, and we'll do our best to keep you informed and make sure that your interests are represented. So that's generally what I wanted to say about that. I think it is a big step for this community, and I'm excited that I get to be part of this community. There are lots of other cities that have representation, so I don't think you should be worried about the optics. It's roughly 50, so that have representation specifically outside of just the Association of Washington Cities. So I don't think it's something that you should worry about in terms of having that be something that gets undue attention. So,
Councilmember Good,
well, I didn't interrupt if you weren't finished.
No, please.
I guess I'm curious. I went down for City Action Days 1 year. Is that something you imagine having? You know, the politicians going down, or would it be more helpful if you took staff? Like if you took our community development director or our public works director to meet with people and talk about things, you think that's helpful at all?
That's probably a conversation I would have with you all and with Greg, and we would decide based on the agenda and what you want to accomplish here, whether there's things that are in alignment that make sense to have staff. I know this year the Association of Washington Cities they've already kind of established their legislative priorities. They're going to be focusing a lot on what they call their 3H strategy, homelessness, housing, and human services. They'll continue to be a strong advocate for you on public records and some other things. So that's certainly a decision where I would expect we could have some back and forth, and you could provide me some insight on what might be appropriate.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Great. And do you want to slide into the agenda at this time? And
absolutely. You saw in committee we talked about it in your packet is the legislative agenda for 2017. Basically broken down into three broad categories. One is on the transportation side to ensure that our transportation projects remain funded, and Brian had alluded to those. That's both the monies that are currently going to DOT for the interchange improvements at Slater and the money that's scheduled to come to the city. We've received some already, but more in the future for the Thornton Overpass project. The next middle section is to promote multifamily housing. This may play into one of AWC's legislative priorities. If you're aware, if you're a community of over 30,000 population and you have a targeted area down in your city core, there's the possibility of a developer not having to pay property tax for, I believe, something like 8 years and up to 13 years if they have affordable housing. Anyway, there's a deferment of property tax to encourage multifamily development in the downtown core, and specifically an inducement to have less than market rate housing downtown. I'm not sure of the genesis behind it, but there is a 30,000 population minimum threshold. We're going to see if there's other communities as well as AWC that might be interested in lowering that threshold. I think if we had those type of inducements here in the city, we might very well see some of those projects downtown that have kind of been on the bubble that might indeed actually occur. But this is something that would have statewide effect, which is actually kind of exciting when the top section for transportation is obviously locally focused. The last thing is maybe some pursue some strategic opportunities. You're aware we're going to be expanding our wastewater treatment plant. We'd like to be sure that there's or find out if there are some grant or extremely low interest loan programs which would help mitigate any additional sewer rate increases we would need to do in the future. And then we talked about possibly a couple of capital projects, the Riverside Park, and then the last one is more of a transportation one with Smith Road that's always had some on-again, off-again interest. But as Brian mentioned, these are just the things that we've thought of to the extent that there'll be targets of opportunity or opportunities that just might arise down in Olympia. I'm sure Brian will keep us apprised and kind of see where the legislative session kind of weaves over the next year or so.
So, Council, you've had your input on the legislative agenda. What would be your pleasure this evening?
Q.
Councilmember Watson.
Move to approve Agenda Bill 1611-002.
Second.
It's been moved by Councilmember Watson, seconded by Councilmember Birch to adopt the legislative agenda and send it down to Olympia with Brian. Discussion. Seeing none. All in favor of adopting the legislative agenda, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The agenda has passed, and we welcome you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be seeing you again, I'm sure. Too.
Sally Ford will protect us.
Moving on to public hearing, low-impact development zoning text amendment. Is that Ms. Miller or Mr. Burnett this evening? Welcome. Haley.
Did you have her write 146 pages?
Yes. PowerPoint presentation. She's going to read the entire
They call it the Yori special.
So good evening, Haley Miller. So this is a zoning text amendment that I'm bringing for you tonight, and it does require a public hearing. And this is a continuation of our updates we've been working on throughout the year. The Department of Ecology requires that the city go through its municipal code and remove any barriers to low-impact development, which will be an emphasis put on the new stormwater manual that we're adopting next year. So we're hoping to bring these through by the end of the year. I have a few more that I think I'll bring next time. So the majority of these are in Title 18 zoning, and we removed barriers and added some encouragement language in here. And then while we were in the codes, we did a number of minor code scrub items. So there's a lot of code changes here, so I was going to ask you guys if you wanted me to go through the majority of the changes or just hit on the high points or just be available to answer questions if you've already kind of gone through it.
Sounds like you're giving us three options here.
Yeah.
Highlights, questions, what was the third one? Point by point.
Yeah.
Was it different than what you gave us at committee?
No.
She did highlights.
That's what I thought, highlights at committee.
No changes though since committee?
Nothing's changed since then.
Are there any like big changes that would really affect people? Because I'm seeing the adult family home definition change. Is that going to affect?
That's required by the state to be placed in residential zones as a permitted principal use, and that applies to just adult family homes of six or less, not more than six, which puts it into a different commercial category. But essentially, they'd just be applying for a home occupation permit, and the city would still review it for the building code and development code.
But that was a state regulation you had to...
It's a requirement that it's in there. I don't think that there's any really major items in here that... What do you think? Any that we should bring up?
That was the one that jumped out. I don't remember.
Yeah, we combined the definitions chapters. There was two different chapters in the code that had two different definitions for some of the words, so we combined that together. And then later this year, the code company will be adding a little definition bubble against the words so we can just hover over it when I'm at the counter and I don't have to go find the definition. It'll show. So we're trying to combine those to make it more straightforward for people.
So council, this is a public hearing. Would you like to go right into the public hearing?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it'll take very long, but we are required to do that. So special instructions, we will open the public hearing at 6:13 and change, and our city clerk will read special instructions for a public hearing.
A public hearing is a formal opportunity to give testimony to the council for consideration in their decision-making process. Written comments may also be submitted to the city clerk prior to the beginning of the hearing. When the mayor calls your name, proceed as follows. Audience members who signed up prior to the beginning of our meeting will be called first to speak at this public hearing. If you were unable to sign up before the meeting, you will be given an opportunity to address the council once we've gotten through all the speakers listed on the hearing sheets. Each speaker should state his or her name and address for the record and will be given 3 minutes to address the council. When a large group of individuals supports the same position on an issue, we encourage the selection of one or two representatives to speak on behalf of the entire group.
I've already opened the public hearing, looking at a blank slate, looking at a really excited group of people that are checking their phones for the football score. This is your chance to speak on this low-impact development ordinance. Seeing none, I will close the public hearing at 6:14 and change. City Council, what is your wish this evening? Councilmember Birch.
I move that we approve the ordinance AB 16-11-003.
It's been moved by Councilmember Birch, seconded by Councilmember Kaler to adopt the low-impact development zoning text amendment. following the public hearing. Any questions from council? Seeing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. And the low-impact development zoning text amendment has passed 7-0. Thank you, Ms. Miller. Item F, City Development Standards Overview. I bet you this is our Community Development Director, Yuri Burnett. Welcome.
Good evening, Council. Yuri Burnett, Community Development Director. Director Renz, Public Works Director Renz, and I are going to present this together. Our main objective tonight is to give you a broad overview of our development standards and the current update that's going on, and also to seek direction from the Council as to the level of detail that you want us to provide you over the next 6 weeks or so. Similar, I guess, in many ways to the amendments that Haley just brought forward, there are a lot of technical details in the development standards, and ultimately what we're going to request of you is that you will have all the red lines available to you, but we won't necessarily go through those very technical details. Instead, we're wanting to concentrate a little bit more on the policy decisions instead of how you build a storm drain. So, starting off, the state, as Haley said, does require that the city review and, if practical, update all of our city standards to reflect or remove barriers to low-impact stormwater development. But since our development standards have not been substantially updated since 1995, going through these standards to see if there are barriers for low-impact development, we also have opportunities to go beyond those basic stormwater modifications. So the presentation is going to concentrate on the background discussion, the goals that we have in this current update, including the scope of the update, talking about our points of emphasis, and then our success factors. So we begin with what are development standards. Well, they're kind of a lot like a zoning in a way, but it's the infrastructure zone version of zoning and building codes. Many of our development standards are actually below the ground, so you're not really going to be able to see what a lot of our standards are dealing with. It's in our pipes, it's in our sewer and water conveyance, it's in our stormwater that you might not always see, which is one of the reasons why we don't talk about them all that much. They just are, and you don't know that they exist until they start to fail. So this applies to both public and private projects, which is something that is important, because in a small city we tend to have applicants for private projects come and say, I want the same deal that you gave yourself, city. So this is an effort to make sure that we address those issues and be as transparent as possible. Right now the standards are composed of 13 chapters. In the stormwater sections, we're looking at consolidating that down, so we're going to end up with probably 10 or 12 different chapters in 5 sections. The administration section is where you really do get more of your policy decisions, and those are the ones that we're going to want to really emphasize to council. Then we have our streets, trails, and utilities, where that deals with our street standards, as you might expect, utilities, pedestrian, bicycle facilities. We do not plan on bringing a full discussion of our street widths back to you before January, because we recognize that has a lot of different things at play. It really speaks to what you want your streets to act as. It's not just the 1950s version of streets being the only requirement for streets is to convey traffic. It's more about what kind of streetscape you want. How does stormwater relate? How does parking relate? So it's a broader discussion than just the development standards themselves. Of course, stormwater, reminding you that these are Washington State standards. We adopt our own interpretations, I guess, of those standards, but they're ultimately the law of the land for Washington State. So we don't have the option necessarily to not adopt these standards. Land alteration and grading, which is really focused on land disturbance. That is the permit that allows these things to move forward. And then the standard details, which are the drawings, which from a technical perspective are really the most important things. This shows you the details that we have accepted as being the valid way of developing or building this infrastructure in Ferndale. Our goals Well, these were last really updated in 1995, and the version of our standards that we have right now is a scanned PDF document. So simply converting that to electronic puts us in a much better position for searchability, for indexing, for cross-referencing, hyperlinks, those sort of things. It's just a function of the times that we now have the opportunity to do this. We're looking to update the standards to match our existing process. So we're not looking at anything revolutionary here in this current go-around. We're wanting to create certainty and clarity, which is what applicants look for. They say, tell us what the rules are, but also providing discretion to our professional staff led by the Public Works Director to say, this makes sense. A small deviation from the standards makes sense here because it's going to allow this to move forward, or it's going to give us the same bang for the buck as we have right now. Right now, just to tell you just a really brief story, I sit across from Art Longstreth right now across the hallway. Kevin sits, you know, basically next to him. Haley sits right across. There are certain days where Art spends the majority, no joke, the majority of his day debating with applicants over the meaning of words from 1995 when Art knows that they no longer apply, the applicants know they no longer apply, and Art is trying to protect the city and the city's infrastructure. And having him negotiate over this dead language, basically, is really tough, and it's not an efficient use of his staff time. We're looking to update it to reflect new development methodologies. Water still runs downhill at the same rate that it did back in 1995. The basic engineering principles are by and large the same, but there have been some changes, especially when we're talking about stormwater and other things like that. We also, just switching it to electronic, it allows for future updates. The updates to be fast and efficient, so they're not intimidating. So, reflect new technologies. And we're about halfway done with this presentation right now, incidentally. so wake up. As I said, the basic engineering technologies have not dramatically changed, but there are some examples where back in 1995, ditches, you put ditches on along the sides of the roads. That's not something that we're looking for now, at least as much. We're looking more for bioswales or rain gardens or other things alongside roads, or sometimes to prevent folks from putting in stormwater technologies within our road that we will then have to maintain. And that has come up repeatedly recently.
Yeah. Way back in 1995.
Way back in 1995. We were wearing flannel back then, and I guess some of us still are. let's see here. So reflect new technologies. Here's, we're talking about what's possible now. This little thumb flash drive here, that would have cost about $1,000. It would have cost more because it wasn't portable back in 1995. It was huge. The simple fact that we have the ability to do what we're doing right now could not have been envisioned back then. And it takes so much time for staff and for the applicant to design based on these old 1995 things, where nowadays it would be so easy for them to click and drag a standard detail into their AutoCAD drawing. They can't do that right now. They need to, well, they can use a snip tool and use it, but we can make it so it's much easier for them, where we're not talking about necessarily changing our standards. And that's important, where we're not doing this to make it easier for development as far as what they put in the ground, but...
Or to make it tougher for them.
Or to make it tougher. But when we are removing the obstacles where it might cost an applicant over the course of a project $500 or $1,000 more to navigate inefficiencies, then yeah, I think we would be unapologetic about saying, yeah, we want to remove those obstacles so we can really concentrate on the actual standards. And that makes it easier, where if they come to us and they say, gosh, we're still upset because we think you're requiring more than another jurisdiction, but we came to that conclusion rapidly, that's a good trade-off, I think, for the city. We feel that the requirements should be consistent from project to project, and that the requirements should be clearly established in the development standards for the purpose of efficient design and review. Probably preaching to the choir a little bit, but what we sometimes see is, well, okay, you know, a logic question. If A equals B and B equals C, then shouldn't A equal C as well? But in our standards right now, they don't get to that conclusion. And we say, I'll have what he's having, where they see that we've allowed an applicant to do this over here. And so I ask for the same deal. We need to be able to demonstrate why that first applicant was unique, or if we can't demonstrate that, to allow the same. And that's what our updates do now within the administration section. We do believe that the public works director needs to be able to account for unique site conditions and to reward innovation, where what we're not wanting to do is have you at a hearing or at an appeal of the public works director's decision weigh in on whether you think something should be a 6-inch pipe versus an 8-inch pipe. Quite frankly, you won't know, and you'll probably want to defend staff. And sometimes staff might be wrong. What we're wanting to do is we're wanting appeals of technical decisions to go to the hearing examiner. And we want that the not appeals, but the deciphering of the intent to go to you, where you create policy, he interprets that policy, and he interprets it for both technical and policy language as well. But to do that, we need to have specific criteria for deviations and for variances so that we can, again, replicate and say, this is not the same as this, and that's why you have a different standard. One example where that can come into play is roadway widths, where we do have the minimum width established by standards, but to allow reductions based on certain criteria that would be listed. And we already do this, where over on the South Church plant just north of Douglas Road, we have this road, which is at 50 feet, which is 10 feet less than the required right-of-way. That was allowed in the past and probably would be allowed now because it's a cul-de-sac, because it's a straight shot. We didn't have a lot of bends for the utilities to go through, and it worked, and it works. That's something that we would have the ability to do in these standards for Kevin and his staff to make those technical calls to say, we can still meet the intent of the code and allow for a reduction, or to require, in some cases, an enlargement or an expansion if the situation warrants. We also are very well aware of the fact that one bad apple spoils a bunch, where when there's language in the standards, 90% of which are still good, but if there is a sentence here or there that is outdated, the whole standards are treated as if they're outdated. And as soon as an applicant stops wanting to utilize the standards because they believe it's outdated, then it's going to be so much more cumbersome to go through. So a code scrub of those standards is really going to allow us to work through that. An example of that, our standards still do reference the stormwater manual that was in place actually before 1995. So it's referring to the great-great-grandfather of the current standards. And in fact, Ecology, which runs the show, says this manual has been replaced by newer revisions and is no longer supported by the Department of Ecology. Yet that's what our standards still say we utilize. Everyone knows that we don't, and we haven't, but changing it so that it reflects that is just simple. So, success factors. Right now, we do have significant staff transition. As you all know, Art Longstreth has retired, and he's working with us on a contract basis. We have, 3, 4, 5 new public works employees within the last year, replacement or new positions. So change does bring new opportunities, but it's also, if we had radical changes right now when people are just figuring out where Main Street is compared to where Vista is, it's not the time to, you know, re-educate everybody. We can make changes as we go forward after the end of this year. We're looking to address the low-hanging fruit in the existing procedures and the change of formatting, where we're keeping it realistic. We're trying not to bite off more than we can chew here. And then again, as staff gets online, as we identify things that still need to be changed, we can continue to make those changes as we need. So it's something that we can work on. We want to provide you standards that are easy to navigate, that are legally defensible. Our city attorney's already reviewed the proposed changes and feels that they are much stronger than what we have now. She has said to us at many occasions that of all of our adopted regulations, our development standards are most risky if we move forward with our existing standards. And we don't want to provide council with development standards that are transformative or revolutionary at this point. If we want to do that at some point in the future, we can, but it's more important that we get this done. And so, in order to get it done by December 31st, we're asking if you support this general direction. That we focus on updates for ease of use, that we have a clear process, that we make the existing processes more transparent, that we'll continue to tweak it as necessary, and that we'll be positioned to make future updates easy and efficient. So, we're wondering, do you want us to bring the standards as one package, either at the second meeting, which it's going to be really tough to do, the second meeting in November, or the first or second meeting in December, or do you want to break it down into some of those sections that we talked about, administration, technical, and details, and start bringing it to you, second meeting in November, first meeting in December, and the second meeting in December?
Council, before you weigh in, I'll just share a story. I met with Yuri a couple months ago, and you brought this subject up and shared some of the same stories of frustration. So I said, well, Yuri, just describe the whole development standards in a word. I can't share that word in public. But what occurred to me was how much frustration that is for staff, but also for developers. And so I wrote back to Yuri and basically said that, you know, what we really need fair for everybody is clarity, fairness, consistency, reasonableness, workability, functionality, and protection for our cities. I don't see any choice here. We need to move forward with this, and we just need direction from you as the best way to go about that. Councilmember Goodrich.
I just have a question in what you, in some of the things that you've seen in other changes we've made in other code sections and stuff. Are you going to be taking out language that's specific, like you said there, where they have to submit something on a 3.5-inch floppy to make it so that as future technology changes or things change, that we don't have to keep making changes, or we can just say, hey, reference the current stormwater things instead of referencing the 2000 whatever, you know, so that we don't find ourselves in 5-10 years down the road saying, well, those guys back in 2016, they adopted this, and it's all ancient history now, so now we got to redo the whole thing again. Yeah.
So I'll go first, and I think that Kevin can chime in too. I think the answer is yes and no, where for some things such as adopting the current standards, we do have sections that say this standard or the most recent edition. There are some cases where we do want to be clear and transparent over which one we are using, especially at a period of transition like after this year.
Yeah, especially, I mean, with regard to, you know, excuse me, like with what stormwater manual we're operating under and some of those other ones that are outside agency regulations that we're having to comply with, I think that getting those in and getting it clear and concise on what people are having to comply with. So I think that, you know, Yuri's right, and that the answer is yes and no, just depending on what section it is.
And then we are trying to go through and identify where language might become dated, but at the same time, we do want to provide clear direction to the applicants over what would be acceptable. So, you know, the 3.5-inch disc question, obviously that's a dated one. What we might do, the decision card that we lifted from you today as far as the electronic plan review, more than likely we're going to start accepting more and more plans that are electronic rather than paper. And so that's going to be some wording that we want to put in there that gives them some clarity, but whether that is an email or whether or not it's an AutoCAD, we want to be careful.
Yeah, and those are things that as we move towards that, you know, taking in electronic submittals, is that we do need to be rather specific about what format those are in and make sure that the electronic software that we're utilizing to review them is compatible with what the submission is. So there are some areas where you need to be rather specific and others that you can, you know, be a little bit more future-proof with.
And the great thing about it is we're going to go through a relatively extensive process and discussion on these. But thereafter, if we change our methodology and it's this one sentence, it's going to be easy for us to give you a 30-second, I won't be presenting it obviously, a 30-second presentation to committee, hey, we need to change this so it's no longer 3.5-inch disc, on consent, and then done. And so not making it so that future updates aren't intimidating, so we don't have a 21-year gap, so that it's a rolling, this should be a living document.
Councilman Goodger?
I just had a follow-up thing, too, that in this type of the changes and things like that, realistic, how much input does council really have on this, and how much is it being driven by state or other regulations or just, you know, bringing things up? I know you're saying, well, do you want it in pieces or do you want the whole thing together? In a way, to me, it depends on, well, really how much of it is really, you know, council-related versus this is stuff that we have to do. We can say, well, gee, you know, we want 18-inch storm drains. Well, is that really a thing that we as a council have a place to say, or is that...
My feeling is that the administration section of the first two or three chapters, that's the policy where you have clear guidance. You know, this is how you use these standards. Then thereafter, you're right, there is a lot of stuff in there where do we have limestone for our trails? Is that our standard detail, or do we have some other surfacing? Where then it becomes increasingly technical thereafter, where I would guess that you might geek out on it on an individual basis, but generally, the engineers have designed it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing with the standards. Going through with the technical details, we're, you know, engaging with our engineering consultants and helping to draft those sections, and then also with the standard details so that we have that, you know, tie together between the details that are being provided and the standards that are within the code, and making sure that those are, you know, good, solid engineering principles going into that design. And I would say that that's not really a place where we want to, you know, engage in a political discussion about it, more in that policy section, as you already is saying up front, as to the overarching, you know, how these standards are applied to the development.
And you will have the opportunity to geek out. I mean, you guys will see all of the changes. It's whether you want to discuss them in detail.
Councilmember Watson.
So do you just want to come to us with policy and then save the standards for the end, because we won't have much input on the standards? So just come with those things that you really need us to have time to think about, and then less and less time that we need to think about, save that for the end?
Absolutely, and that would be our preference, because we have most of the policies already drawn up, and we're still working with our engineering consultant and staff to put together the more technical details.
That's what I would prefer. If you need us to, like, really change some kind of policy or think about it, give me more time. For the standards, I just want whatever record maybe gives you, and that'll work.
Is that consensus of council? Councilmember Goodrich?
I just have another question. Didn't we do some design changes when Janice was here? I remember seeing some drawings of vaults and stuff like that.
Is this kind of
a continuation of that, or is this entirely different than what we kind of did? Or do we not necessarily approve everything?
I don't think that I can speak to the full effort that was, that involved Janice, but I do know that our development standards include a collection of drawings from past directors, so from Janice and Bob Seeley and on down, that there's a number of different directors that have approved the details that go into those. So.
Is that something we're going to be keeping or changing? Is that
the intent of the upgrade, to get all of the standard details into one concise format and have all those adopted as one standard format. So those would all be put together into one package. I don't, you know, there's some of them that are staying exactly the same and just being updated to the, you know, the new header, footer, and consistent look throughout, and then others that are changing based on the detail and new construction methods.
Is that helpful to you?
Very helpful.
Council, any more direction for staff? It's a big project, and it's really important. So let us know how we can be helpful to you.
Well, and the public works staff, consultants have been just absolutely tremendous. It's been really, really fun working with Art and Larry, where now that they see that it will be a helpful tool, they're in Kevin's and my office on a fairly regular basis, say, change this, change this, change this. So that's good. I think there's buy-in on staff.
Very good. Public Works, anything else? Thank you, staff, very much. Go on to item G, Mayor Salary. I thought I would take this since my name is in the title here. I want to thank council for their work on this. What I thought I would do is
I've listened to the tape of the committee, and I think I got what you're doing. It's a kind of a complicated narrative, so let me read back to what I came up conclusion from your meeting. This is also for the audience as well, so if I'm wrong on this, let me know, but I think I got the gist of it. Here's the background on tonight's ordinance. Toward the end of the last mayor's term, the previous council voted to change the salary of the incoming mayor from $2,619 a month to $1,644 a month beginning in 2016. That was Ordinance 1825. Now, by ordinance, this new amount was chosen by a method of averaging the salaries of all the mayors of all Washington cities that fit within a population range of 7,500 to 15,000, and then reducing that average by 10%. That city range, 7,500 to 15,000, designed and published by the Association of Washington Cities, represents about 35 cities. This resulted in the current 2016 monthly salary of Ferndale's mayor of $1,644 a month. Just a side note I wrote here, there are some, in a few comments in committee and in open session, some have suggested that council has a similar formula for their salary. They don't. They do a different way. This is only for the mayor. Only includes the mayor tonight. Anyway, and unexpectedly, this same averaging formula being used to determine the 2017 upcoming salary of the mayor for this budget resulted in a lower salary than 2016. An analysis of the data shows why this occurred. Some larger, higher-salaried cities moved out of this AWC population bracket, and a number of smaller cities crossed the threshold and joined the bracket, and those smaller salaries were lowered the average. And this then brought the ordinance unexpectedly in conflict with the Washington State Constitution, Article 11, Section 8, which states that the salary of any elected official cannot be reduced during his or her term. So the city's Finance and Administration Committee last Wednesday is recommending this ordinance as that remedy. In the ordinance, the mayor's salary is fixed at $1,644 a month for 2016, but shall increase, as does council's salary, at an annual rate of, quote, 80% of the Seattle Consumer Price Index as measured from October to October, unquote. In other words, about 80% of the rate of inflation. I hope I got it correctly. Council, what is your pleasure? Councilmember Olson.
Move that we approve Agenda Bill 161105.
Second.
It's been moved by Councilmember Olson and seconded by Councilmember Watson to adopt the salary ordinance. Is there any discussion from Council or, for that matter, from the audience? We generally take public comment. Seeing none, if you're ready for the question, all in favor of adopting the ordinance, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The ordinance has been adopted, 7-0. On a related subject of salaries, going on to certain contracts of what we call the non-represented employees. They're not part of a union, mostly senior and staff. This is item number H, and by way of background, just a statement here, the mayor and the staff recommend the approval of two-year contract extensions for several senior staff members. For one staff member, Mr. Sweeney, this is his first two-year contract with the city. For another, Ms. Katie Ratter, it's a necessary and appropriate two-year adjustment of her salary. Per council request, you have been provided the contracts in their whole, and as our city practice, they will all be available online. If you want to find those, I believe you go to Human Resources and Contracts, and you'll find those contracts, as we do like to do that. The mayor has looked individually at all the contracts and compared them with cities our size. Cities up to 30% larger than Ferndale, and 30% smaller than Ferndale, and just and only on the west side of the Cascades, the west side of the state. And I've concluded these contracts fit well within the range of salaries for these positions and responsibilities. Council, these are modest cost of living and performance raises of 0.5% plus inflation. Council, we are truly fortunate to have such a professional, qualified, dedicated, and hardworking staff. I knew that as a council member, and I know it even more so as mayor. And though it is not my goal to overpay anyone, because with you we are stewards of the public purse, it is my intention to ensure that they are fairly paid for their good work. Again, I urge adoption of these two-year contracts. Council, what is your wishes tonight? What are your wishes tonight?
Quick question.
Councilmember Watson.
For Susan Duncan's contract, I thought we were also going to make an adjustment in her salary in January 2018. Are you just getting CPI for 2018? I thought it was going to be like Katie, where you got one and then
I got one in 2016 and then I get one in 2017.
Okay, that's right. Okay, yes. So you did get the two. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good question.
Then I would move to approve all the contracts as written.
It's been moved by Councilmember Watson and seconded by Councilmember Hansen to adopt the two-year contracts for the remainder of non-represented staff. Discussion from council, from the audience. Anybody else? Seeing none. All in favor of the motion, say, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Nay.
The ordinance has passed. The salaries have been adopted. 6-1 with Councilmember Olson voting no. Thank you, Council, very much. Going on to Washington Street House Purchase. We're in a money-spending mode tonight, aren't we? Mr. Young.
Yes, and if you remember, about 2 years ago, we had the opportunity to purchase the house on the corner of Washington Vista, and then we eventually removed that house as the first step in acquiring property to, at some point in the future, construct a roundabout at that strange geometric intersection. Currently, the house next door to that corner lot is available for sale. We did, as is required, get a market analysis done. That market analysis has come back at $215,000. We are asking that you consider purchasing that house since it is for a future transportation project for which we could indeed exercise eminent domain if there's some advantages to the seller. But in this case, we actually have just one willing seller and a willing buyer, us. And the purchase price is supported, or the purchase price we are offering is supported by the market analysis. The funding would come from a combination of traffic impact fees and REIT 2 monies, which both have over $500,000 in them. And so staff is recommending that we purchase this home. In committees, it was brought up that what are we going to do with the home after we purchase? We know eventuality is that we would, after acquiring it, eventually remove the home to make room for a roundabout. But in the meantime, what are we doing? It was suggested, and I thought this was a wonderful suggestion, that we explore the possibility of using this home in that interim period for some sort of transitional housing, helping out those less fortunate. I understand that, I believe Councilmember Watson may have spoken with at least one of the social service agencies about their interest in and their need for this type of housing.
Well, no, I was able to talk to Laura Parker of Interfaith, and she couldn't make any promises now because she needs to talk with her board, but she was very interested. I don't know how many of you realize there's already a triplex here in Ferndale, and they've helped 18 families with 48 children basically come out of homelessness in just 2 years. And these are people that once they, you know, get out of homelessness, they stay out. They have an amazing track record, and I would like to see us, rather than us leasing it and trying to have renters, find some way to work with Interfaith so that we could basically have three more rooms for people who are living on the street or in their cars. Again, Laura's very interested in having this discussion. We'd have to work out the details of the costs and that sort of thing, but she's very interested, and I think it'd be a worthy cause.
So, Councilmember Goodrich next, and Councilmember Olson. And Greg, could you just quickly talk about the fine? How would we pay for that?
Yeah, exactly. It would be a couple.
Someone's going to ask.
Yeah, it's $215,000. It would half come out of traffic mitigation, half out of REIT 2.
Reserves.
To follow up on the aspect of using it for transitional housing, I also had a chance, the seller's call, because they're interested in, of course, knowing how long they need to pay their mortgage payment and what the city was doing. So I've been keeping kind of abreast with their real estate agent. They called me directly. And they have, and you probably have seen the pictures, they put some money into this building. It's a cute little house. And when I told them the distinct possibility that we would use it for transitional housing, they seemed extremely pleased, because the idea that they have put in newer appliances and new flooring, and the fact that all of these improvements would go towards such a worthy subject was something that I felt that they got some pleasure out of. I also mentioned to them that we don't know anything now, but it's a possibility in the future that should we eventually want to remove that house, we could possibly actually move the house to another lot that the city owns somewhere and continue that legacy of providing that home for transitional housing. The state constitution says you cannot have a gift of public funds except for the support of the poor and infirm. And in this case, we could actually, for a dollar or some nominal amount, lease this property to Interfaith or some other group, and that way we would not have to worry about who they're going to. They wouldn't call Bo when the heater goes out at midnight. They would actually have a group that would maintain the property potentially in perpetuity.
Councilmember Goodrich.
My concern is in regards to future aspects of it. In regards to, have we done a home inspection of it? Are we getting into an asbestos issue like we did with the other house, or an underground tank like we got with the other house that we didn't know about, where we ended up incurring a lot of additional costs when it came time to tear it down? Where we know up front anything like this. And the other thing is, too, is we're looking at turning it into a rental or doing something. Are we going to be required to do anything to it, ADA accesses or anything, that will be an additional cost to the city? Or if we do it to Interfaith, will they be the ones that will be doing those updates? I know I worked for the Opportunity Council, and we had additional housing and different things, and I was doing maintenance in those different houses and stuff. So I know there was requirements that had to be met that they had to do.
Yeah.
But they, Opportunity Council, did it. It wasn't the building owner. So I was wondering, make sure we're not getting into any hidden costs that will be a major impact to the city down the road.
Starting from the back end going forward, the aspect of any improvements that would be needed to use it as transitional housing, my hope is, and this is part of the discussion we'll need to have with Interfaith, is that given a dollar a month or some very modest rent, that they would, and I do believe they have the abilities to make those sort of improvements. My understanding is that I know that we've not done an asbestos inspection because we have not contemplated tearing down the house. We have really no way of knowing if there's something under the ground because it's literally an unknown. But I think for the next few years at least, this house would be used as transitional housing. And should there come a time for us to move it, then we'll need to do those investigations. But that would be the case anywhere we go. I know that with the house on the corner, one of the issues was it had a full concrete basement, which made moving the house very difficult because there was a chimney that went from the basement through the roof. This house does not have that sort of situation. It's been well maintained. The prior owner, I believe, maintained it pretty well, and the current owner has done a lot of work on it as well.
There. Councilmember Taylor.
What about insurance, like liability insurance?
I apologize.
I believe that was something that, again, if we lease it to Interfaith, that would be their responsibility. In a lot of ways, they're taking on that responsibility, and that's one of the considerations for the extremely modest rent. In fact, almost a nominal amount of rent, because they are in the business of obtaining this type of insurance, maintaining these kind of homes, doing the upgrades that might be needed.
And if they decide not to do anything with the house, then we're responsible for the insurance?
If we were to rent it out at a market rate, yes, we would probably, we would need to have insurance. It would go onto our city insurance. The renters would naturally have to get their own homeowners insurance if they wished.
Councilmember Olson.
I'm kind of with Brent, and I were thinking about the same thing, remembering the asbestos. I would be for buying it, but I want to see a home inspector come in there. I think it's $500-$600, and inspect it for asbestos. And as far as don't know what's in the ground, that's easy. It's a metal detector, and they can go over there and see if there's any kind of giant tanks or what have you, or maybe even the owners know if they abandon a heating oil system, which was quite common in those years. So I'm with the same thing with him. I don't want to get stuck like we got stuck on that first house.
We could actually buy the house contingent upon a satisfactory home inspection.
And for the city, this is, in a sense, an investment. I mean, I believe we'll put that roundabout in someday. But if not, turn around and sell the house. So this is basically taking money, securing it in an asset that's going to appreciate depending on the inspection. So sounds like a consensus to get the inspection and move forward. Councilmember Watson?
I guess that's my question. What would be a good inspection? Because you're saying if I made a motion to do it, you know, assuming there was a good inspection, what do you consider good? If we found asbestos, would we not buy it?
Well, if asbestos...
Because asbestos, if you just leave it... If
right, exactly. That was my point. Asbestos left in place is not an issue.
Yeah.
Only, in fact, the only reason why we actually entered into any sort of asbestos investigation with the house we tore down is because we tore it down, because literally it was going to be dismantled. To the extent that it would stay in place, then there's really no problem as far as leaving it in place, assuming that is, it's not friable. It's something that is actually either in tiles or something like that.
Councilmember Olson.
We're not going to leave it in place. Eventually, it's going to get torn down.
Right.
So that doesn't even enter into the equation, in my opinion.
So we
still should know if it's got asbestos.
Oh, I'm not that. But I'm thinking what the inspection would show. I was thinking of a kind of two purposes for the inspection. First of all, is the house reasonably maintained? Is it structurally
sure.
sound? Secondly, and that's a short-term answer as far as the advisability of using it as a rental. Long-term, what is our asbestos exposure? Is it just some of the tiles in the kitchen, or is it, you know, is it more extensive? So we know what we're getting into later on when we do indeed want to tear it down. And then we can find out if we simply move the house, how much of that would need to be abated.
Right, but I would like to get that information brought back to us.
Absolutely.
So that we... And the other thing... you mentioned we're not doing eminent domain, so he's not going to get that tax break, right?
No, this is for a transportation project, so we could structure it.
What was he trying to sell it for before?
It was $217,500, and I understand that there's an offer right now for $218,000 or $218,500. We will be offering $215,000, so by saving the real estate excise tax, the seller actually comes out with a little bit more than they would.
Define a little bit more than they would.
I think the savings is about $4,000 on the real estate excise tax, and given that there's a $3,000 difference between
that's
the
not
offers,
worth it,
they'll end up with just
okay.
a small amount.
Councilmember Watson.
So can you just go get the house inspected and come back to us in 2 weeks?
Well, actually, yeah. In fact, we could, you know, let the realtor know and the sellers, mm-hmm. to be fair, that the purchase is approved contingent upon the results of the inspection, and then mm-hmm. you will bring those inspection results back to you, and then you can make that final determination.
Because that would also impact whether we could even have renters, depending on, I mean, if there is asbestos of some kind, or if there's other issues.
And this may be a chance, too, for Interstate to spend a little bit more time thinking about the home, maybe even looking at the home itself.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Just so everyone knows, a regular home inspection is not going to be a detailed asbestos inspection.
No.
That's a whole separate inspection, and that will cost more. So a regular home inspector will just say, this may have asbestos, this may have asbestos, you know, but it's not going to be detailed as far as...
So you suggest we make that motion to include...
There would actually be two. There would be a building inspection, so to speak, a home inspection, because home inspectors really can't opine on asbestos. Asbestos inspectors really can't opine on structural integrity. So it would actually be two.
So I think we're looking
if
for both.
Actual dollar
yeah.
for that,
no,
do you have a cost range of what you think? I mean, 500, 1,000?
I cannot remember what the last one. We just had an asbestos survey done on the field house, and I don't remember off the top of my head what the cost was. But I guess...
$300 to $500 or something like that? I don't remember.
It depends on the scope of what is found in the investigation. So if an asbestos... survey is done, they go into the house, and if there are tiles that appear to contain asbestos, they'll take a sample of it. If there's ceiling tiles that appear to have asbestos or insulation, each one of those suspect materials will be sampled and then taken back to a laboratory, and analysis will be done on those samples to determine whether they have asbestos. So the cost of an asbestos survey is really dependent upon what kind of materials are encountered during that assessment. But one thing that I'd throw out is that you know, given the does it have asbestos, does it not have asbestos, I agree that, you know, we should probably know up front, but to the extent that we envision that we're going to be doing the roundabout, we purchased the previous property, tore it down in order to make way for the roundabout, we're purchasing this property to make way for the roundabout, I don't think that we would reorientate or rechannelize the roundabout to avoid a property that contained asbestos. So to the point that it does or does not have asbestos, I think is just a factor to consider when we go to tear it down. It's going to be a little bit more cost to deal with that or not. But I don't know that it necessarily is the deciding factor between...
We're not making an investment decision on a house here. We're looking at property for future expansion. Mm-hmm. It's a good, well said.
Yeah.
Any more questions from council? I think there's a consensus that we get a double inspection, full meal deal, and come back to you at the next meeting, which is shortly.
Mm-hmm. It's 2 weeks.
Would that include below the ground?
I will throw out the caution that the last asbestos survey that we had, there was a little bit of lead time associated with it. So we'll do our best.
And Councilman Burst is asking about the ground. So
yeah, there's a lot of times, and maybe Kevin can speak more to it, there's a phase one investigation, then there's like a phase two. A phase one investigation goes through the documentation that's available. Perhaps in the assessor's records, there is a record of a location of an underground fuel tank or something like that. So it's going on the record to see what sort of records there have been either for the installation or the removal of something that would not be obvious above ground. The phase two is when you literally go out there and start digging around, and you don't know until you find these things. So my thought was that we would do a phase one where we would go through the record to see if there was anything obvious. Again, we do know at least one of the prior owners, so we can talk with them to see what their experience has been, and the house has been there for a while. I think it has changed hands a couple times, so there should be some records out there as to what's known.
Councilor Olson.
What we're trying to avoid is all the wonderful surprises we had on the corner. So
yeah.
We're just trying to be proactive, because if I remember correctly, that asbestos removal was, what, $10,000 for that place?
I wouldn't be surprised.
It was high.
Yeah, because that. Yeah.
So that would directly affect the cost.
Right. And in that case, I think literally the siding on the house was asbestos siding.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, to tear it down, you had to remove it first. If we were just moving the home, we may or might not, we would not have.
So it sounds like a consent. Oh, two more over here. Councilmember, you haven't had a chance. Hanson, go ahead.
All I was going to ask is the seller going to be patient? I mean, we're talking about 2 weeks, maybe even longer, before we can make a decision about whether or not we're willing to buy it. Is the seller willing to be patient, being that they have another offer on the table?
Right. They are eager to find out the answer to the question, but I did not get the impression that they have, you know, something else in the wings that they have to close by a certain date. They were just, I think, wanting to find out in what direction the city was going to go.
It doesn't help them, but they're not likely going to sell a house when buyers know the city is looking at taking it. It's one of those awkward things. Councilman Rosar.
Well, that was partly my question as well. I mean, I'm comfortable saying let's make an offer on it contingent with the inspection. We all agree we want the property.
Could that be a motion from the council member, perhaps? Could that be a motion
sure,
from the council?
I will make a motion that we make an offer on the property on Washington Street, contingent on the home inspection.
I'd second that.
It's been moved and seconded. Moved by Councilmember Rosario, seconded by Councilmember Hamilton for the city to make a fair offer on the house contingent upon the inspection's plural coming back positive. Discussion from council. Seeing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. And the motion has passed. Thank you, council member. And there we are at the end of the program there, folks. Mayor reports. First of all, I want to share this announcement about Wayne Larson. Most of you know that Wayne Larson passed away recently. Wayne was a longtime Ferndale resident, and I just wanted to say a few words. Wayne was the construction manager for Nelson Construction, which built several projects in our area, including the Smith Road I-5 overpass. He was civic-minded, always ready to share his ideas on how to make the city a better place. Wayne grew up in poverty on a Ferndale farm, but through his own grit and determination, he oversaw projects worth millions, including the I-5 bridge. He didn't finish high school, but became a valued member of the Ferndale School Board. He raised plenty of hackles, but in the middle of the night when the floodwaters rose, he organized equipment and contractors to stop the flooding. A devoted father, he leaves behind three wonderful daughters. And while Wayne wasn't always the friendliest community member and a bit of a curmudgeon towards the end there, his impact will be felt for years to come. So God bless you, Wayne. Larson. The other item that I have is that the city administrator and I met with Bob Carden today for a few hours. We had a stack of 12 resumes and applications for the chief of police job. We thoughtfully whittled that down to 6, and we will be bringing in people from all over the country, including Georgia, I think, and New Mexico in December for interviews and such. So we will keep you abreast of that.
That's going to bring responsibility.
So, council reports. Councilmember Watson.
If you missed the 17th annual breakfast for the Boys and Girls Club and didn't get a chance to give them a check, don't leave the room.
Well said. Anyone else? Councilmember Olson.
How much are we planning on spending for fly-in and boarding and everything for 6?
That was possible.
Yeah. I started to, but I ran out of time. I was going to actually work up an estimated cost and get back to you.
All 6 that you've been
No. Most are local. State of Washington.
Oh, all right.
I mean, 2 are from out of state.
I misunderstood.
3 out of state, 3 in state.
Okay.
More council reports. Councilmember Goodrich.
I just have a question as we're getting toward the end of the year. I know last year we kind of took off December things, and we have a January 2nd council meeting scheduled, which means we have a December 27th committee meetings. Are we still planning to do that, or are we going to look at...
What else was there?
Is something happening in December?
Yeah, the only thing I would say, and seriously, my hope is that we can adopt the budget in the first meeting in December. I think we've charted out enough sessions, and I want to thank you for tonight's efforts on parks, because that, good or bad or whatever, that was a big decision that, and I think we made some headway on. So I think the rest of the budget is not going to be that laborious. So yes, my hope is that if we adopt the budget on December 5th, we could not have our meeting on December 19th. But right now, looking at the future agenda, there's nothing on the 19th that would be so important that we could not slide to January 6th.
And staff would want that as much as council, so we're working toward that.
Would you still have committees on the December 27th? Because that actually is, because a lot of us would be out of town.
What we'll try to do is, to the extent we can, we'll maybe just try to not have a lot of complex or controversial issues on the second. And we might be able to also send out some information to you as far as what the agenda is. So if there are any issues that you feel should be deferred until later in January, we could certainly do that. So we'll try our best to keep the January 2nd meeting as light as possible. Because it's the 27th, I would hate to have, of course, everyone to, as you mentioned, a lot of people may be out of town anyway. This is a hard time of the year to try to pull these things in. So.
Thank you, Councilmember Goodrich. Any other council reports? Councilmember Taylor.
On November 18th, Watkins Dispute Resolution Center is having their 14th annual Peace Builder Awards Gala, and they're giving Star Park an award.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh.
We're going to be there.
I'm
excited.
I can't be.
Thank you.
And we're receiving the Collaboration Award for building community through volunteer service.
Because we get along so well in this city. Right?
Make it work.
And you can attend this. There are tickets. I don't know how much there are, but they would love to have you in attendance if you can be there.
Have you applied for the AWC Award?
No, we have not.
Other council reports this evening? Looking,
okay.
I don't see any.
We have a contract.
Moving to staff. Mr. Burnett from the Community Development Department.
A couple things. One of them is
share with Riley, but the first one, well, Riley and many of you council members, the first one, just during this meeting, we did go live with our new map
function. This is cool.
So we're going to be able to put a URL on our website. It allows a lot more functionality than our current one, and I won't go into a whole bunch of details beyond just showing you right now it loads faster than the other.
We're gonna bring Brenna in and do a show and tell. It's very cool, yes. And it'll be useful stuff for council, too.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
The other thing, a couple of weeks ago, staff, council, and some experts in the field met to discuss Ferndale Made. That's our concept where, as you know, Ferndale is kind of lumped into Whatcom County, and we're just north of Bellingham, and there's not that much to distinguish us. And as we transition from big box to looking at getting more people who, you know, white-collar jobs or manufacturing jobs, what we found is what really sets Ferndale apart maybe from any other jurisdiction in Whatcom County is that within the Ferndale market area, Lemonation, Cherry Point, Ferndale, we make stuff here. So the Ferndale Made concept, we sat down with Port of Bellingham, with Western, we've talked with the Chamber and, of course, with Council. And so we laid out an action plan that's fairly aggressive over the next 6 months or so to get up and running and to really start promoting that concept, not only locally, but and not only state, but possibly nationally and internationally as well. So looking for your feedback, and we'd be more than happy to send that document to the rest of the council as well.
So I have two quick Ferndale Made stories. The first is at the Greenhouse Annual Christmas thing they do every year, and had a person selling giving chocolate samples away, delicious dark chocolate, and I was talking to him. He didn't know who I was, and he goes, "Yeah, we live in Bellingham, but our factory's in Vancouver, but we think we'd like to locate to Ferndale. Do you know anything about Ferndale?" I said no. Anyway, so you already got candy, Bernie. How was that, by the way?
I haven't eaten it yet because I'm still going through the kids' candy from Halloween.
There you go. Don't give that to the kids. That was a $6 candy bar. And then tomorrow, Riley and Greg and I are touring a sausage factory as part of Ferndale Made. We make hot dogs, so we're going to help us tour tomorrow. So
because in politics, you get to see how the sausage is made.
You get to see how we make. Public Works, Kevin.
Yeah, I know. Councilman Watson had asked that I provide a little bit of an update on a couple of projects that we have going on. One of them was the Star Park bathroom. We've identified that we could actually do gravity with that, so we can avoid using a pump station at that location. So that design is going forward with the intent of being able to proceed forward with something come good weather in the spring, and then
Star Park location.
Yeah, the field house, and additionally, the field house demolition is complete, and that has been removed and the area leveled off. So that is a little bit of an upgrade to the area, I think. So
that's good news.
Got that taken care of, and then additionally, the Main Street traffic lights. We were waiting for traffic to kind of settle down. A couple of components with that, with doing the traffic counts and study of what's happening with the traffic in downtown, is one of them, we had the Washington Street project going on, which was skewing our regular traffic flow patterns around town. So once that project was done, and then getting people back into their familiar habits with traveling through downtown, so getting that to settle down, and then getting school back into session. So it's we're going to be proceeding forward with having the additional counts done, and then the design for moving forward with the optimization of the traffic lights in downtown.
Thank you very much.
What's the update on the Telecom House restrooms?
The Telecom House restrooms are actually, I was down there the other day. They've gone through, they've upgraded the lighting in those. We've gone with the LED fixtures inside the bathrooms, and they're an amazing, they're like maybe 3/4 inch thick LED that's, you know, like a 4-foot fluorescent fixture, except extremely thin up against the ceiling, provided quite a bit more light within the bathrooms. And then they're proceeding forward with the other upgrades to the facility, the painting and everything else going on down there. So the crews are actively working within the restrooms to get those completed. So
beautiful.
Hopefully we'll be done. It was the intent to have them available for the old-fashioned Christmas, yes.
Thank you. Thank you. And our finance director, Salmanin. How are we doing? Okay. Good to hear that. Our chief of police, Chief Knapp?
Thank you for being here. City Administrator Young.
Nothing really. My Ferndale Made Story is, some of you may have seen this, there was a TV series called How It's Made, and they highlight, you know, how candles are made and how pool sticks are made. There actually is an episode I watched on Samson Road. And so it actually is something I was just happened to flip through the channels, and it looked very familiar. And so we actually have some nationally recognized things that are made in Ferndale.
So we could add that to the website.
Yeah.
And our newly contracted communications officer, Mr. Sweeney.
Just wanted to give you guys a quick update on all the projects I'm working on. We have LTAC submissions are out right now. So if you've got a great idea for a thing that'll bring people to Ferndale, we want to hear about it. Deadline is at the end of next week, and we're hoping to meet here for the end of November. So we've also streamlined the application a little bit, so it's not quite as onerous on our applicants in terms of paperwork, but not in terms of standards. I'm doing a reorg of the community development side of our website. We're launching a whole page on private development projects, so when people are curious, what are they building across the street, they can really easily figure out what it is and how they can comment on it. And we're providing some information to the public about how to be effective when they're commenting on land use decisions and those sorts of things. The gala was already mentioned. Ferndale Made was already mentioned. Rollout of the new online map system. I'll be bragging about that. And we have a bunch of kindergartners touring City Hall later this month. Should be adorable.
Very good. City Clerk Duncan.
Did we put in a submission for the sign to LTAC application for funding?
I have another week. But you are going to put something in,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
In prior to the deadline.
I mean, give them to your contracts.
City Clerk Duncan.
I just wanted to share in my other life.
Oh,
great date night opportunity for a lovely holiday show like Christmas at the Dolphin Theater Guild. Tickets have the box office hasn't even opened yet, and some of the shows are already sold out. So you don't take it that way. Don't wait for the box office.
I think that runs the whole house there, and congratulations staff for sticking with us another 2 years. We need a motion, excuse me. Motion to dismiss.
So moved.
Been moved and seconded to dismiss. All in favor say aye. The motion is carried.